Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm so delighted to be sitting across from Susanna Cahalan. She is the award-winning New York Times bestselling author of Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness, a memoir about her struggle with a rare autoimmune disease of the brain. And her second and most recent book is called The Great Pretender. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I have to say before we begin, you have been so wonderful to this book, and I just want to thank you for your support.
Well, thank you for writing it. So there you go.
Oh, that's the best.
I mean, and so usually I like to just talk to authors about their most current book, but I feel like Great Pretender is so tied into your experiences from Brain on Fire that maybe you want to go back and give us a little run through.
Sure. Yeah, no, I definitely came. I mean, there's a conversation between Brain on Fire, my memoir, and this book that, I mean, I am in both books. And,
right.
And which honestly wasn't intentional. I didn't want that to happen.
But it added something.
It had to. I tried writing without it, and I just couldn't find – I couldn't find the voice, and I just kept referring back to my own experiences. So
– And you have such a unique experience, right, to come in and you witness firsthand how the medical establishment treats people with physical illnesses versus what are described as mental illnesses.
Exactly. So like that personal place I felt like was necessary in terms of moving forward to talk more generally about the field.
Yeah.
So yeah, so in 2009, which this whole thing was chronicled in my memoir, I had a rare autoimmune disease that attacked my brain, but was initially misdiagnosed as a serious mental illness, initially bipolar disorder, and then right, as my psychosis intensified, schizoaffective disorder. So I mean, I experienced hallucinations, delusions, paranoia, you know, the whole grab bag of really wonderful,
yeah, fun things.
Yeah, right.
And then there was a shift in the way you were treated.
Yes, absolutely. So the minute the proper diagnosis, which was confirmed via a spinal tap, mm-hmm, kind of was delivered, the whole feeling surrounding the people who were taking care of me just totally switched. I mean, and I was only in for a month, so I didn't experience I didn't experience it for that long, but it was palpable. And my parents felt it too. And in fact, I'm kind of feeling it by proxy because I don't remember a good deal of that time.
Sure. So
a lot of it is even kind of in the words used in my medical records. It's how my parents were treated, you know.
Give me some specifics.
I mean, you know, there was a constant kind of threat woven throughout my medical records where there was these three words, transfer to psych, and it kept showing up in my medical records as my psychosis was intensifying. And there were even small kind of judgmental things that showed up. One of them was I wore a white t-shirt and black leggings.
Yeah.
And that was early on in my hospitalization when I was probably entering into the most acute psychosis part of this, you know, the symptoms that I was presenting. And the psychiatrist documented what I was wearing, calling it revealing. And it was proof of her bipolar 1 diagnosis, which has a subset of hypersexuality as one of the symptoms. So it was just – it's
– White t-shirt.
White t-shirt, leggings. I mean, I wear that – that's kind of what I wear every day.
Yeah.
You know, this was not anything exceptional at all. But what happened was she was seeing me through the prism of the mental illness label that she had applied. And she was – and anything that she could see that could fit, you know, that label – she would include in her records.
And so they're like psychiatrists or like detectives, like trying to put all of the clues together to make the thing, to solve the thing.
Exactly. That's
but it's not
put, yeah,
solvable.
In some ways, yeah. I mean, and in some ways you can't really blame the psychiatrist for seeing that because on paper, it made sense. You know, I was psychotic and it came out of the blue and probably, you know, had this not been 2009, but was 2005, she would have been correct.
Right.
You know, so I don't really – I understand that they are like detectives. It's actually perfectly put. And detectives make mistakes. They're human beings. And sometimes they see people through bias.
Yes.
And doctors have the same – have that same relationship with patients too.
And even the people who work in hospitals and any institutional place has to – compose a narrative kind of about.
Absolutely. And medicine's all about narratives.
Right.
And I don't think I fully understood that. I really kind of thought about that with Brain on Fire, but ultimately I got this kind of magic bullet answer, this perfect,
right.
You know.
You were the one of the rare people who you had a diagnosis and then you had a plan.
Right.
And now here you are.
Sick, better, you know. And
right.
What I didn't realize when I wrote that book was I knew it was an exceptional story, but I didn't realize how exceptional it was until
yeah.
I started to dive into other people's stories and the kind of history of psychiatry, the history of understanding the question, what is mental illness?
This podcast is brought to you by Catapult, publishers of Rough Magic by Laura Pryor Palmer. If you like your memoirs to revolve around singular experiences, Laura Pryor Palmer's Rough Magic delivers. That's what the New York Times said about Rough Magic, the extraordinary true story of one young woman's experience riding what's billed as the world's longest and toughest horse race. This book will transport you out of your house to the grasslands of Mongolia, where a 19-year-old woman is tearing through the countryside on a wild horse, plowing through illnesses, dehydration, and exhaustion, armed with only a backpack full of snacks, an extremely limited understanding of Mongolian vocabulary, and a weathered copy of Shakespeare's The Tempest, the play that inspired this memoir's title. It's one of those rare memoirs like Wild or Educated, where the writing is as incredible and unique as the story. And it's not to be missed, especially now that it's out in paperback. Rough Magic by Laura Pryor Palmer, out now from Catapult.
You even write in the book about how you've gone and done talks
yeah.
and just – you stand for everything that medicine can do.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that's a lot of pressure.
In a way, yes. And I started to understand what happened to me in a different way. I mean, I think it is my illness, my, you know, recovery is proof that we have advanced in some kind of exceptional ways. But what I started to realize was that's not the only narrative, and that medicine does not follow a linear path of progress.
Right.
I got caught up into forces that were larger than me and kind of washed me to the right shore. And
right.
I got the answer that I was seeking, but most people don't.
Most people don't.
No.
And so how did you get to this point where you decided my second book is going to be about this experiment mm-hmm. and these seven quote unquote sane people who get themselves committed.
Yes. So it kind of furthering from that personal place after Brain on Fire came out, I started lecturing widely
yeah.
about my condition and interface a lot with psychiatry. And one time I was at a psychiatric hospital in North Carolina. And after I would just talk about what happened to me to a room full of doctors, one came up to me and said, I think we have someone here who had what you had.
Right.
Yes. And I kind of call her my mirror image because I did find out she was diagnosed with autoimmune encephalitis, which is the disease I had. But she went misdiagnosed with schizophrenia for 2 years. And the assault on her brain was too much, and she would never recover as I had and would operate the rest of her life as a permanent child, which were his words.
Ugh.
So the stakes are so high.
Right.
You know, and it angered me.
Of course
I was angry. I was also kind of confused about what are these terms that we're using that can derail someone's treatment?
Yeah.
And what do they mean? Where is solid ground here? And I was talking about this mirror image with two neuroscientists at Harvard, out of Harvard, who went to a book reading that I attended. It's kind of this wonderful
– I love that.
Yeah.
What a network of it.
Yeah, I would never – as a tabloid news reporter, and yeah, I was just at the New York Post, I never thought I'd be saying these words. But, I mean, that's been one of the joys of writing The Great Pretender is I've been able to talk to some really just remarkable
yeah.
people. But I mentioned this woman, and one of them said to me – oh, you two are like modern day pseudo patients.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what she meant by that. And she kind of explained a little bit about it. And that night I went home and Googled, she actually sent me the study on being sane in insane places, which was written by Stanford professor David Rosenhan and published in Science in 1973. And then I lost 6 years of my life. That's it. Yeah.
But how did you connect with his – I mean, so you got a treasure trove, basically,
yes, yes.
Of stuff
yes,
from him.
I did. You know, he passed away in 2012,
yeah.
which was the year Brain on Fire came out, but also a year after I started, a year before I started working on this. So I wasn't going to be able to talk to him directly.
Right.
But when I read the study, which is, you know, these eight people went undercover in psychiatric institutions across the country. They all supposedly presented with just one symptom. I hear a voice that says thud, empty or hollow. And just based on that, most were diagnosed with schizophrenia, one with manic depression. So, that, I mean, the idea of misdiagnosis was like really interesting to me. And then there were also the other things that he describes. It reads like fiction. The study.
No spoilers.
Yeah, no spoilers here, but it's beautifully written. I mean, even the first line, like, if sanity and insanity exist, how shall we know them? Published in Science Journal, which is, you know, one of the premier academic journals, very, for lack of a better word, like highfalutin, you know, like really difficult studies I would not be able to read and understand. But there was this beautiful study, so neatly arranged and understandable and beautifully written and
philosophical.
Exactly. It was sexy, you know, like
it was sexy.
Like, there was one point.
Pizzazz.
Yeah, seriously.
Yep.
David Rosenhan. But at one point, he tells a hospital who kind of – this doctor from a hospital said, this would never happen here. We would immediately identify them as fakers. And so he said, okay, 3 months, I'm going to send pseudo patients. The doctor reports back that he found 41 with relatively high certainty that they might be pseudo patients. And David Rosenhan tells him, I didn't send one. I mean, it's just great. I mean, it shows this nimble mind at work. So I became fascinated by David Rosenhan and determined to learn more about the study and him and the other people that he somehow managed to
convince to.
How did he do that? You know, it was wild.
I feel like it's such a trope in like dramas that like you get committed and you. It's one of the worst nightmares you can have.
Yeah, like wrongfully accused of a crime / wrongfully accused of being insane. I mean,
And proving sanity.
Right. How do you prove yourself? Because everything that you do becomes further proof of your insanity. I mean, he did really kind of pinpoint one of these deep fears that I think humanity has wrestled with for a good deal of, when we've been able to write words, you know, we've kind of grappled with these issues. And the study encapsulated it and also gave it some data, and it was published in Science. It gave it kind of legitimacy and proof. So I went down this rabbit hole and I was able to find his unpublished book, his diary entries. Which are fantastic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, eight banker's boxes worth of letters that he wrote throughout his career. He was a beautiful letter writer. So I didn't get to talk to him directly, but I really got access to his mind through his writing.
Yeah. And then you got access to these other people who are unnamed in the Science article.
Right. So what I started there was, okay, David Rosenhan, his experience, there were some fascinating details, and he really came alive off the page. He was a pseudo patient.
Right.
And he went undercover at Haverford State Hospital for 9 days. And It most of the study actually revolves around his time. And, you know, he describes how at one point he was writing in the day room.
Yes.
And you know, this writing actually showed up in his medical record as signs of writing behavior, which was signs of his insanity or signs of his schizophrenia diagnosis. And one time he was sitting and writing, an attendant came up and started talking to him. And this was the first time any of the staff had really identified him as a human. You know, everyone else kind of never looked at him in the eye, made him strip with the door open. They didn't have, bathroom doors on the, it was just, he was depersonalized. And this attendant started talking to him, and they had this wonderful conversation kind of gossiping about everyone on the ward, who was in for what and which doctors were good and bad. And at one point, they noticed that the nurses are laughing.
Yeah.
And he realizes later that the attendant had actually mistaken him for a doctor. And that was the only reason he was talking to him. I mean, moments like these, they're just magical. But the problem was, as I started to dig into his experience, I started to find some issues and started to find some inconsistencies, which made me make it more important to kind of find the other people involved in the study. I also was fascinated with why and how did he convince them.
Right.
But I became obsessed with this. And in fact, you sell on a proposal. And I sold this book as Committed, not The Great Pretender.
Oh, right.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yes,
to me.
Because I was celebrating this edit. Yeah.
Explain the title a little bit.
Yeah.
It has multiple meanings here.
Yeah. So The Great Pretender has three meanings. The first meaning is The Great Pretender is actually a class of illnesses like the one that hit me.
Right.
Which they are kind of known as illnesses that masquerade as something else.
Right.
And in my case, an illness that masquerades as a psychiatric condition, but as a quote unquote neurological condition, which, you know, these dichotomies I think are very outdated and primitive, but that's where the origins of the word The Great Pretender comes from.
Right.
And then there was the kind of more obvious choice of the word The Great Pretender, which is, you know, David Rosenhan and these seven other people pretended to be patients.
Yes.
So they're pretending. And then as I started to peel back the layers of this study and really started to investigate it, because the book in many ways became this journalistic odyssey I did not anticipate.
Sure.
It being the thrust of the book, The Great Pretender started to take on a kind of more complex meaning in a way.
Yes.
Yeah, yes.
We don't have to go further than that. let's go back, because before Rosenhan, Nellie Bly did something similar.
I have to say I love Nellie Bly. I always have adored Nellie Bly. And there have been some great books about her kind of race around the world.
Yes.
And I mean, I just she's just so wonderful and just smart and aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And ambitious and I just really very much admire Nellie Bly. And I always knew that she went undercover in a psychiatric hospital, an asylum actually. But I didn't really know the extent to which what she actually did until I started to read about her hospitalization. And there were some kind of great books that talked about what it was like on Blackwell Island, which is where she went undercover, which is now Roosevelt Island.
Which is just wild to me that it's just right there.
It's right there. And I drive by it at the FDR. I'm like, this is where she was. And I think about her. She took this kind of ferry over to the island. And she was 24 years old. And the New York World, a tabloid in the city, you know, kind of just sent her there. And this was, Dickens had visited the island and wanted off immediately. And I was so horrified when I read the New York Times piece saying that Dickens tried to get his wife committed because he wanted to have an affair with an actress.
Because he knew.
He knew how bad it was. So that was horrifying when I heard that, because I love Dickens.
Another problematic fave. So many of our faves.
Seriously. But so Nellie went undercover for 10 days in Blackwell Island. And what she saw there was horrific. I mean, the minute she landed, she was thrown into a bathtub that was filled with human waste and dead vermin, where she was basically waterboarded. And that was just the beginning. She heard and saw patients beaten. One was beaten to death. And she saw women there who were in for various reasons. One, because they didn't speak English. Hmm. And the average stay there hovered between 10 and 20 years at the time.
Gosh.
She was really putting her life on the line for this story. And she described it as a human rat trap. Once you get in, you can't get out. And luckily, she got taken out by a lawyer, because she probably would have spent a good deal of time there.
I mean, I was also fascinated by all the precautions that all of these pretenders had to take before going in, because you need that lifeline on the outside.
I mean, I just can't imagine with her specifically.
Yeah.
Which also, she kind of illuminated a little bit what some of these other, the pretenders that I talk about, because some of them were around her age too. They were students. And this was a different time. Nellie Bly went in the, 1870s.
Right.
The pretenders went in between 69 and 71, approximately. But so it's a different time, but grappling with many of the same issues, maybe not as people were not in for 10 and 20 years in the same way. Patients were still beaten, there was still terrible conditions. So, there was a conversation with the time 100 years before.
Yeah. And I think we just like to think that medicine always advances and the asylums are gone. Yep. And so, but the diagnosis of a mental illness can ruin a person's life very easily.
And it's also, there's so much we don't know.
Yeah.
That was the shocking part. And it's not just psychiatry. I mean, I focus on psychiatry in the book. But I really went through a tour of what we don't know in medicine. We don't know how like Advil works. We don't know we don't know what causes Alzheimer's. We don't know what causes dementia. We don't know what causes sudden infant death syndrome. I mean, there's so the list of what we don't know far outweighs what we do. And coming from Brain on Fire, where I felt that we had figured this whole thing
out.
It was an education for me in many ways.
Tell me what you've been reading now that you're not reading old diaries and letters anymore.
I'm still on the kind of path of I can't get myself away from this path in a way. But there are two books I've read recently that I've read multiple times. One of them was Esme Wang's Collected Schizophrenia.
Have you spoken to her? Okay, good.
I actually wrote her a fan letter.
Okay, good.
And met her when I was in San Francisco very briefly, and she's amazing. I mean, this book is phenomenal, and I'm bizarrely in it. So I'm reading it, and I'm like, I'm being seen. She understands. And then she literally writes about Brain on Fire, and it was this – so I had to write her. And there were so many overlapping things that happened between this and her experience, and she's phenomenal. I've never seen anyone write the way she has about these issues in with such clarity and elegance. And just, I love that book. On another side of things, which are kind of not related to this, is I read Sigrid Nunez's The Friend.
Yes.
For the first time a month or two ago. And I'm still, is this something you've read? Have you read this?
I mean, it's got all my main things.
Yes. Like,
men behaving badly, dogs. Yes,
I know. It's just,
publishing.
Did you love it?
I loved it. Of course I loved it.
Okay, good. Yeah. I love this book so much. I mean, I know this is not necessarily kind of new, right?
I don't know. Anytime you have a good book recommendation, it's best to let it fly.
I love this book so deeply. Those are the two that have been on my mind. I haven't been reading as much as I want to.
Well, you've been on tour.
Yeah. I know it's hard to read on tour for some reason. Yeah. But those two really right in the heart. So.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review. And check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.